From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. Unfictional is a program of stories and original documentaries, and today on the program, a story of two men from similar backgrounds who ended up on drastically different paths. Producer Jesse Hartman is the son of an Episcopal priest, and he'd long been aware that a colleague of his father's had a son who at one time lived the life of a fugitive, on the run from federal authorities for more than 15 years, and who was now in prison.
You kind of become who you appear to be, you know. But, you know, every time you hear a siren, every time that cop car drives by, you start seeing, you know, guys in suits, and you kind of wonder.
They started a correspondence and then a series of phone conversations. Jesse was fascinated by the fact that this other person, who grew up in such a similar world, became a man who left behind him a trail of robbery, murder, hijacking, and double lives. It's a repeat broadcast of a story produced in 2013. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional and Preacher's Kid.
Hello, you have a call at no expense to you from
William Graham,
an inmate at
Nevada Department of Corrections, Northern Nevada Correctional Center.
To accept this call, press 5. To refuse this, you may begin speaking now.
Good morning.
Hey, Morgan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, so it worked out. You got my letter.
Yes, I did.
Morgan Graham and I have been writing each other by snail mail for 2 years. His real name's William, but he adopted an alias years ago when his life took some serious turns.
The crime associated with the bank, I have 2 life sentences and 20 years for attempted murder. I have a 30-year sentence for air piracy, for the hijacking. I've been in prison almost 20 years now. I am eligible for parole, and I come up pretty much every year. And the prospects of that, I couldn't really say.
I wouldn't say Morgan and I are friends, but we are connected. We're both PKs, better known as preacher's kids in Episcopal church lingo.
Federal sentencing was today. The judge gave him 30 years, the parole at 10. The good news is that he made...
That's my dad, Bob Hardman, reading a letter from Morgan's dad, Holt Graham, from 1993. It's an update on Morgan, who's just turned himself in after more than a decade on the run. My dad's going on 74 years old, and he's had Parkinson's disease for the last 17 years. Every voice you hear in this story is the voice of a PK, including my dad. My grandfather was an Episcopal priest, too. Growing up a preacher's kid, you're expected to turn out one of two ways, either a choir boy or the devil's spawn. My dad was the former.
I would say Sunday was my happiest day. I loved going to church and loved being a participant in the choir and the acolytes, etc. I felt the Spirit move within me.
I'm somewhere in the middle. I never got in much trouble, never wore leather jackets or rode motorcycles, and never got caught up with drugs. But I can't say I felt the Spirit move in me, and I always wondered what the other side of the PK coin might be like. When we got that first letter in the mail detailing Morgan's trouble with the law, I was 19. I desperately wanted to know more about his journey to the dark side. All these years later, I got Morgan's mailing address, and I wrote him to see if he'd tell me about the last 4 decades of his life.
I live right now in a cell, which is 7 feet by 9 feet. I'm on the bottom bunk. There's another man who lives on the top bunk. So you can imagine, it's kind of like living in a bathroom with another person. All of my worldly possessions, such as they are, fit into a cardboard box and a plastic footlocker. And it's a very gray place. You know, the whole interior is painted gray, and it's kind of dark in the cells. And there's very little color. There's very little anything.
In the late '60s, amidst assassinations, anti-war protests, race riots, and while watching his native Washington, D.C. literally burning, Morgan Graham was a teenager trying to navigate high school.
You know, at 17, I was a dropout and working for a moving company. You know, just basically pushing boxes around, not really doing much of anything with my life. Very much just adrift in the storm. Going to anti-war demonstrations and smoking a lot of weed. Just listening to Led Zeppelin. You know, I had made up my mind that I was going to be this, you know, this great revolutionary hero. Take up the cause and be Che Guevara and all that stuff.
On top of all of this, Morgan's parents were in the midst of a divorce. With his own family falling apart, he embraced a new one that moved into the neighborhood. Charlie Tuller was a disgruntled government employee in his late 40s, divorced, suffering from diabetes, living with his two teenage sons, Bryce and John.
I remember very clearly I came out of English class one day at T.C. Williams High School. And there was this long-haired guy standing there, skinny kid with a lot of hyper and energy, and that was Bryce. And he said, "Hey, are you Will?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I heard that you know where to score some weed," because they had just moved into the area. Charlie, the father, allowed us to sit in his house, in his living room, which was not more than a couple of blocks away from the high school. Cut class, listen to music, and smoke weed.
Charlie Tuller convinced Morgan and one of his sons to join the army and get weapons training. Tuller began to fill Morgan's paternal void, created by the absence of Morgan's own father, who was dealing with his divorce. Ultimately, Charlie Tuller, along with his two sons and Morgan, formed a kind of JV version of the Weather Underground, the leftist radical group that in the late 60s and early 70s advocated for the overthrow of the U.S. government.
And I remember being very nervous and very scared. It's strange what happens to you in moments like that. Sometimes you just go into this numb autopilot. And since I'd already abdicated really my thinking to Charlie, I was just going along. It seemed at once very ordinary and very frightening.
A botched bank robbery in suburban Washington, D.C., is how the Tuller Gang announced its presence to the world.
The bank manager ran out, and John comes out and grabs him. Now, Bryce and John were dressed as phone company guys, right? So that's how they had gotten him to go, supposedly, to look at the phone lines. They were going to get his keys and open the day safe. During this whole time, Officer Gonzalez had come in through the front. Charlie is standing in the lobby there of the bank, in the main part of the bank, just kind of acting like a customer, right? Gonzalez walks through the bank, speaks to one of the tellers, goes towards the break room, at which point Charlie pulls his pistol and shoots him in the back. The officer goes down, and then John opens the door and proceeds to shoot him several more times. And at that point, Bryce looks at me and he says, "Let's get out of here," and we ran.
Without getting any money,
yeah. I found out very quickly that I have very little capacity for violence. I was a basket case after the bank. I went into this shutdown mode. I was awake and moving around, but I wasn't really alive. You know? And I got berated a lot by Charlie for being useless. Yeah, he was quite capable of quite a bit more violence.
They escaped and headed south on the run. Bryce, one of the Tuller boys, had been shot in the hand. Morgan says Charlie Tuller shoplifted bandages from a drugstore, but that was a temporary fix. The group needed a bigger solution, and Charlie had an idea.
Charlie finally says, "Look, you know, Bryce needs medical attention." And this was a time when, you know, there was a hijacking to Cuba, it seemed like, you know, every week. There was a group of guys who hijacked the plane just prior to the one we did, and he got the idea from them. So the idea was we would go down there and we'd get Bryce fixed up, and the Cubans would help us return to the States and become great revolutionaries.
After fleeing D.C. in a station wagon, Morgan and the Tullers headed to the Houston airport and waited for an Eastern Airlines flight to board. When the time was right, they stormed the gate with guns a-blazing. Charlie Tuller shot and killed a gate attendant who tried to intervene.
When Charlie decided to go ahead and take the plane, I saw that as my way out. You know, I was going to go to Cuba and would be welcome there, and I'd end up, you know, in sort of a revolutionary paradise.
Morgan and the Tullers weren't greeted by the Cubans like great revolutionaries. They were arrested on the tarmac of the airport and taken to prison. Morgan says the jail cells were like dungeons, and there were frequent interrogations.
They asked about our politics. They asked about the crimes. They asked about our motivations. They asked about our backgrounds and who we were. They were very puzzled by how the son of an Episcopal priest ended up on their doorstep. But I can't say that I blame them.
After 3 months, Morgan and the Tullers were released and set up in a kind of halfway house full of other hijackers and revolutionaries from around the world. This mansion in Havana suburbs was full of Black Panthers from Chicago, Puerto Rican separatists, and more.
There's a lot of reading of Lenin and having endless discussions about the proletarian revolution. That's kind of what you do. There are study groups and meetings and all kinds of badly hatched conspiracies to do this and that. A lot of guys trying to stay in touch with their people wherever home was and staying active, because the reality is that Cubans never trusted hijackers of any kind. The Cubans may have sponsored revolutionaries throughout the hemisphere, but they didn't sponsor a lot of people who were hijackers. Most of them were told to look, either work or go to school or leave.
Morgan says the Tullers didn't want to assimilate into Cuban society. They kept up their dream that the Cubans would give them money and weapons and send them back to the U.S. to complete their revolution. They were eventually kicked out by Cuban authorities and put on a flight to Miami. They re-entered the U.S. with false papers and picked up where they'd left off, robbing a Kmart in North Carolina. Bryce Tuller was arrested at the scene of the crime, while Charlie and his other son, John, fled back to D.C. When it was confirmed Bryce was in jail, they turned themselves in, winding up with life sentences. Morgan stayed behind and tried his best to create a life for himself. He worked on construction crews, helped run a printing press, and eventually started studying Spanish at the University of Havana. He says when he saw how controlled Cuban society was, he began to question his revolutionary ideals, but he didn't totally renounce them.
I found an article from the Washington Post, July 8th, 1975.
Oh, God, yes.
Do you know about that?
Yeah, I remember that.
I dug up an interview Morgan had given to a Washington Post reporter from Havana. He was asked about the killing of the police officer in the bank robbery.
It says, the killing of Gonzalez, Graham said in the January telephone interview with the reporter, quote, was self-defense. Revolutionaries aren't murderers. If he was Cuban-born, Gonzalez was Cuban-born, and wearing the midnight blue and a badge and a gun, he was a gusano.
Yeah.
Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, a statement that I have regret immensely. I didn't shoot him, but I was there, and I was in on that, and I can't shirk my responsibilities there.
1 minute remaining.
Okay, let me call you back.
Okay.
All right.
If you grew up in the church, like me, it's pretty hard to wrap your head around a preacher's son turned revolutionary. Thou shalt not kill comes to mind, so does the godlessness of communism. The worst thing I can think I've ever done was skipping class in middle school or stealing a pack of baseball cards. I don't say that with pride. One of the reasons I've been fascinated by Morgan is that I often wonder what useful things I could have learned from crossing the moral line more often. Why didn't I? Another anecdote from my dad might help explain the kind of environment I was raised in. His major transgression in life involves Morgan's dad, Holt Graham, his mentor and seminary teacher.
I, at one time, in a final exam, was stopped by a question because I couldn't answer it, and I looked on my neighbor's paper and began to copy down his answer. And I was so overwrought with grief that night that I didn't sleep at all. And I went to him the next morning, I said, Dr. Graham, I don't know what your policy is for people who cheat, but I cheated on your examination. I deserve to be released from seminary. And he turned to me and he said, Bob, didn't you know that God loves you? And with that, it was like a big dark cloud lifted from my head. And I left that room so relieved that for the first time I realized God did love me.
When I asked my dad about Morgan, he says he remembers him a little from having dinner over at the Graham house. And he remembers hearing about Morgan's flight to Cuba and feeling bad for Morgan's dad. But he's still conflicted about Morgan. While he's disappointed by the fact that I don't go to church, I did, in his mind, turn out how the son of a priest is supposed to.
Well, my hope for you is that you grow up to be outstanding and that you serve others in a way that is thoughtful and giving.
But my dad doesn't know as much about the second chapter of Morgan's life. The 15 years that went by between Morgan leaving Cuba and him being caught, and the 20 years he spent in prison. In 1975, the Cubans kicked Morgan out and gave him a one-way ticket. He flew to New York City and walked through security with a Virginia driver's license. Nobody stopped him. After spending a year in Cleveland, where he stole the identity John Richards from a death certificate, he headed west.
God's gift to fugitives at the time was Greyhound. When I made my way to San Francisco. San Francisco is a good place for fugitives because people don't pry. And you can be whoever it is that you say you are making yourself into. I mean, people go there to transform themselves. It seemed to be the right place to go.
Morgan moved into a co-op housing situation and began dating one of the other residents, a Brazilian woman who was getting her teaching degree. We'll call her Anna. He got a job at a wine distributor that paid in cash, and he joined a softball league, which became his closest group of friends. Morgan even reconnected with his sister, who worked as a piano tuner in the Bay Area. They'd set up fake appointments for her business once a year and talk. For the first time in his adult life, things felt normal, sort of.
You kind of become who you appear to be, you know. But, you know, every time you hear a siren, you know, every time that cop car drives by, you start seeing, you know, guys in suits, and you kind of wonder.
Morgan didn't tell anyone in San Francisco about his past, but one day, his girlfriend Anna told him that her student visa was up. Happy in her relationship, she wanted to know if Morgan would consider marrying her. The answer was,
well, yeah, but I got this thing they got to tell you about. It just makes it a little complicated, to say the least. I have to tell her the story. You know, basically, I said, look, you know, it's great. I really like you to stay. You know, we're great together. But you know, I can't commit to you unless I tell you this. You know, this whole sad tale.
Well, how did she react?
A bit of disbelief, actually. It's such a far-fetched story in some ways. A lot of people, they look at me like, you're making this up. Then I think her reaction was kind of to share in my sorrow of the whole thing. I think she understood on many levels how difficult and damaging the whole thing had been to me.
What if you thought someone you just met was a fugitive you saw on our program?
The Manhunt starts right now.
Meanwhile, thanks to the TV show America's Most Wanted, Morgan's other life was catching up to him. A program detailing his case and fugitive status was aired. Around the same time, the FBI began to squeeze Morgan's family, who knew of his whereabouts. He and Anna talked it over and decided going back on the run was not ideal, despite the fact that they didn't want to lose each other.
It would have been pretty easy for us to just vanish, you know, to get on a flight from Miami to Rio and just not come back. But I realized at the time that that would turn her into a fugitive for all intents and purposes. Then to live with that the way that I had lived with it for so long, I couldn't inflict that on her. It was time to try to do something about the situation, try to heal up me and everybody else involved.
try to find a measure of redemption, I guess you could say.
Morgan called some lawyers and had them notify the FBI that he was intending to turn himself in. He and Anna flew together to Washington, D.C. He pled guilty, so there was no trial. His parents and friends came to the sentencing. To everyone's surprise, he got a harsher sentence than the actual shooters, the Tullers. 2 life sentences plus 20 years for murder and 30 years for air piracy.
And one of the things that I do remember about very clearly about the being in court was that the families were there, the families of the victims. And I remember feeling very clearly for the first time how hurt they had been and how much they despised me. And that's a very difficult thing to deal with.
One of the things I've struggled with as I've listened to the entirety of Morgan's story from age 18 to now almost 60 is when he talks about how bad he feels about the people who died. Arlington policeman Israel Gonzalez, bank manager Harry Candy, and Eastern Airline ticket agent Stanley Hubbard. I don't feel he's as sorry as I expected.
I listened back to the tape, you know, where you talk about the crime and you repeatedly say you're remorseful. It doesn't always sound that way. And
you have to remember where I am. I can't really expose a lot of myself and how I really feel a lot, simply because of the people around me will eat me alive if I show any signs of being emotional or weak or having any kind of humanity. You can't show that here. It's too dangerous, especially for me, somebody who doesn't really fit in to begin with. So, yeah, I may not come across very emotional or very feeling on a phone in the distance, but the reality is, if I really start thinking about these things and how badly my life has gone, I won't be able to function anymore.
As fascinated as I started out by Morgan's downfall, what I've realized is how much alike we are. In the end, he's not the devil spawn version of a PK. He's somewhere in the middle, with me.
I have no intention of becoming a priest, but I feel this weight of acting like one.
Yeah, I understand that. I understand that completely. Yeah, I have very much the same feeling, yeah. It's a feeling that you need to be of service. You know, it's imperative in your life that you have to try to help other people.
Nowadays, Morgan serves as the librarian at his prison, a job his dad held at a seminary in his later years. He's also the art appreciation teacher for inmates.
Whenever I get the opportunity and I get to talk to somebody about art and about the great paintings of, you know, Caravaggio and Edward Hopper and people like that. And every once in a while, I see the light bulb go off above the guy's head, and it's just so rewarding. I feel that in that moment that maybe my life has been worth something.
Despite qualifying for parole in Virginia, Morgan's pretty down on his chances of getting out of prison anytime soon. He says he's not trying to shirk his responsibility, but after decades of staring at prison walls, he's developed an opinion on his situation.
If you do wrong, you should be punished. There's no question of that. There's just a question of proportionality and does the punishment fit the crime. It's coming up on 20 years that I've been in prison. So considering my roles in the crime, how much is enough? That's the question that I would ask people. And I think there are a lot of people that say that I've done enough.
Morgan had hoped to get out of prison to see his parents before they died. That didn't happen. His dad visited him a handful of times, and on one particular occasion, he thinks his dad quietly forgave him.
There's a hug at the end of my visit when I was in Ely, and it just said a lot to me, just the way the look in his face, the hug that he gave me. He didn't say a whole lot verbally to not who he was.
But Holt Graham did leave behind something verbal for Morgan, a prayer. He left it with my dad and a group of other seminarians who've kept praying for Morgan, believing that he deserves redemption. The same redemption Morgan's father showed my dad so many years ago.
Pray for Morgan. Gracious God, our help is in the time of need. Accept our prayers on behalf of your servant Morgan. Grant him energy, wisdom, courage, and strength. In his twilight world on the fringe of knowledge, memory, and attention, may he overcome feelings of anger, sullenness, and hatefulness. In the abrasion of his confinement, continue by your grace his determination to survive and overcome, to learn and to grow. Help him focus on what is truly significant and what has priority. Above all, continue in him the awareness that he is well and truly loved. And with that love, hope endures. May each season bring the assurance that love and hope are born anew. And may that assurance abound in the days ahead. Amen. It's a beautiful prayer. It gives a lot of hope. And father's hope in his son.
Morgan Graham's case comes up every fall in Virginia, a state that grants only around 3% of inmates parole. So he tries to stay focused on his teaching at the prison and his studies as he gets close to earning a bachelor's degree and a paralegal certification. He says he can't undo his past, but he'd like the chance to alter his future.
If I do get out and I am able to do some real good out there in some way, then, you know, that maybe someone would look back and say, well, you know, he wasn't all that bad, at least he tried.
Preacher's Kid was produced by Jesse Hardman and edited by Wendy Dorr. Production help from Tiffany Camhey and Ellie Yu. It was mixed by me, Bob Carlson. And you can find several photos and other information about this episode at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. Also on the website, you can find all the past episodes of this program. You can leave a comment. You can like the show on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, @unfictional. Plus, you can always podcast the show on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And if you do like the program, please leave a nice review on iTunes. It does help new people find the program. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The associate producer is Nick White. Thanks to the Annenberg Foundation, the Goldhirsch Foundation, and the Roth Family Foundation for their support. I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.